Hey there, everybody. This is your pal, co-host Robert. This is a rebroadcast of Forgot My Dice episode 13 titled Meatbag, I Knew Thee Well. The first of our episodes to cover the plane shift PDFs presented to you by Wizards of the Coast. As always, content is a year old and covers topics and news that have long since happened, but feel free to check out the show notes on ForgotMyDice.com and come join us on our new home on the Forgot My Dice Fans Facebook group. Enjoy the show.
Countdown for blast off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire.
Welcome to another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. As always, I am your moderator, Jonathan Edwards, and with me, as always, the dice to my DM screen, Mr. Robert Lundgren.
I thought you forgot your dice.
Hi-oh!
That literally happened the other day.
That did actually.
Let's go play some role-playing games, fellas. I forgot my dice.
Yeah,
and everybody looks at you like, are you plugging your podcast? Are you plugging your podcast right now? Is that your goal? Do you really have your dice hidden somewhere? It's like, no, I actually forgot my dice.
Yeah, you epic failed in the best way possible, one might argue. Yeah. All right.
Remember, anytime you forget your dice, you're actually plugging our podcast. Thank you. The check is in the mail. Not really. We don't have any money.
Before we get started with today's episode, I did want to give a quick shout out to @nerdbro on Twitter. He sent us a really nice note about the show, kind of made both of our days. So
He had the benefit of us getting it like right before we recorded.
Yeah.
It was really fresh on our minds.
Well played, @nerdbro.
Yeah,
well
yeah. Played. If you want to end up on the podcast, send us a note on a Monday. You have a 50% chance of being the recording day.
That is the way to min-max that, without a doubt. So let's go ahead and get started with our off-the-shelf segment. That is, of course, the segment where we talk about all the cool stuff that we've managed to get to the table. Let's flip-flop things for a bit, and let's get video games out of the way first today.
So I've been playing Overwatch, of course, because Year of the Rooster rekindled my love. And then I'm finding, without the ability to play Capture the Flag, which I was not doing very much near the end of Year of the Rooster, but without that like cushion there, I'm finding the game has lost a little of its magic. And I don't know why, because it's not like Capture the Flag was really that good. The exciting bit is they're going to add Capture the Flag to the arcade, and all of the control point maps are getting it, so you can Capture the Flag in Greece pretty soon, too.
That'll be cool. That might bring me back in.
Yeah, and actually, my most hated map actually would make a very good Capture the Flag map, which is the Grecian Ruins.
A tough map.
Yeah, I don't like that map at all. And I hear a lot of people say that, but as a Capture the Flag map, that might actually be kind of interesting, because it feels more like a Capture the Flag level.
No, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
So, since I've been getting bored with Overwatch, I downloaded a game that I bought on my buying spree. I downloaded, finally, I started playing Shadows Over Mordor, which I know I'm like 3 years late to this party.
But it's fun.
It is. Yeah, it was fun. The storyline isn't getting
No, that's me. Not what you get that game for.
Yeah, yeah, but killing orcs in new and creative ways is still kind of fun. And then, you know, seeing little movie bits, you know, it's like, oh, hey, there's Gollum, and he likes me for some reason. Have fun. I'm enjoying it. I don't know how long it'll hold my interest, especially when Mass Effect Andromeda comes out in 3 weeks.
Well, yeah, that's going to suck away all of our interest, period.
I'm having a good time right now. It is filling the void while I'm waiting for Mass Effect and or Capture the Flag to come back. So what have you been playing?
Battlefield 1, of course. I continue to be absolutely infatuated with that game. Actually, you know, interestingly enough, my buddies and I sat down and played Battlefield 4 for a little while the other night. Man, it takes that step back to realize just how polished of a game Battlefield 1 is. It's not just the change in setting. It's such a smooth experience, and it's just so streamlined and to the point. Battlefield 4 just kind of meanders all over the place, and Battlefield 1's this great streamlined experience. And I did have a chance to sit down, and I played the open beta for Ghost Recon Wildlands, which is neat.
I have not heard of this.
So it's this gigantic open map full of missions to do. And do you remember a game called Mercenaries on the Xbox?
I don't have an Xbox.
The Xbox 360.
I skipped that generation. I gave that generation... That was my World of Warcraft phase.
Oh, there you go.
So I missed an entire console generation while I was running around Azeroth.
It's this giant open world. You can traverse it via trucks. You can walk. You can take helicopters. You can zip around all over the place. And you play a Ghost Recon team, which, if you remember the old teams, is counterterrorism, and you're in this nondescript Latin country trying to stop drug trade from coming over the border. The debate, at least, is really, really good. There's a lot of variation to the mission, and it's fully co-op up to four players, which is awesome.
Is this an Xbox only game, or is it?
I don't know. I think it's Xbox and PlayStation 4.
I will have to go look at that.
It's got a lot of flavor of The Division. Instead of being so MMO-ish where everybody's a bullet sponge, you do retain that Ghost Recon where things are lethal. Any assorted geeky goodness that you've had a chance to do?
I also caught the painting bug again. Uh-oh. And by caught the painting bug, I ended up painting for 3 nights, none of which were in the last week. I had a turtle for my Minions faction that I wanted to do.
Oh man, you started him a long time ago.
Yeah, well, I was trying to make him like Gamera. So I finally finished altering him and sculpting all the details I wanted to put on him and redoing his legs. Because his normal legs are very tortoisey, and I'm like, you're supposed to be a swamp turtle. You should have webbed feet, jerk. So I had to put webbed feet on him. I sculpted all these cool details. I made a longer tail. I'll post a picture of this eventually once I get done. And, you know, then he's like supposed to be, and I gave him tusks, and he's supposed to be like Gamera. So I painted him black, and it's really hard to see any details on him, but whatever. Yeah, it's been fun painting again. I haven't painted in a long time, and I am still missing it. I haven't painted in like a week, and I just haven't had time. I'm going to be editing this podcast for the next couple days, so I probably won't have time for the next couple days. Maybe that'll be my carrot. It's like, Robert, if you finish this quickly, you can paint. That sounds like a good carrot. That'll get me to edit this fast.
I cannot.
So if there's like minimal edits in this podcast, you'll know why. Because I failed my wisdom save versus painting.
I've been so busy lately, and I can't wait for my schedule to kind of calm down a bit, because I have been itching to get painting. And now that I'm sitting here right next to the Kickstarter of Arcadia Quest, all those big old chibi guys.
We should have a painting party.
Oh, I want to have a painting party so bad.
Just sit and chat and paint.
I'm down. I'm so down.
And then I forgot to mention this last time, but I read the draft of Tales from the Loop. I gotta say, I was a little disappointed in it.
Uh-oh. In what respect?
Basically, I was reading the setting chapter. They do a good job of talking about the 80s, which reading a account of a decade that's historical that I remember kind of sucks. Makes you feel old.
Yeah.
Basically, the setting did a good job of sort of setting the stage for the 80s, but what it didn't do a very good job of was setting the weirdness, you know, because they were billing themselves as the Stranger Things. I got the distinct impression that they were leaving a lot of the communication of why the setting is so weird to the art. Because the original art book kind of had a story behind it, and I have a feeling that the adventures that are included in the main rule book communicate that story, but it is a little annoying that you have to read the adventures to find out what the weird is, and they don't tell you what the weird is. Like those three towers, those are the cooling towers of the loop, but they don't say why they're there or why they look that way or anything about it. And they don't really talk about the loop. They just say it's there. Yeah, it didn't communicate what I wanted it to communicate, which is, it's the 80s, which is fine, but it's why is all this stuff around? Why are there dinosaurs? Why is there this? And they don't talk about that at all in the setting chapter. And I was just a little disappointed from that. So, Jonathan, board game is up. Bring it on.
A lot of board games. More Star Realms on the phone. Continues to be fun. Played a little more Santorini. Continue to love that game so much. I have found that the more I play it, the more I like it in its core form, without the god powers. Sometimes the god powers seem wildly maladjusted to each other. Some combos are make for interesting matches, but some combos make for some really one-sided matches, and I found that I prefer the base game. It's very much like chess. It's a simple premise with a lot of depth. Had a chance to play a Kickstarter that came in called Quests of Valeria, the latest in a very long-standing Valeria series. It's 1 to 5 players. It's kind of neat. You build a tableau of villagers, and the different villagers give you the ability to take on different quests that pop up. There's a nice push-pull because you can also get rid of villagers to pay for things, and you can also get rid of villagers to alter things. So you have to decide, you know, do I want to complete a quest? Do I want to do this? Do I want to use this villager for money instead? And it's a neat little push-pull. I'm very much looking forward to diving in a little deeper into it and getting to know it a bit better. I also had a chance to sit down with my brother-in-law, and we played Poker Assault, which is a neat game. Basically what it is they have made a standard deck of 52 cards into a faction deck. And so you've got all the standard 52 cards so that you can play poker with them. In fact, one of the things that the game tells you is when you're not playing Poker Assault, you've got 4 poker decks, which is kind of fun. But then you've also got a lot of things written on the core cards and a second set of cards that are for assault cards. And these are faction specific. And it comes with 4 factions. You've got vampires, werewolves, aliens, and rocketeers.
You know. It's a pretty standard mix, I'd say.
Yeah. And each of them has just different mechanics. And what it is you try try and make a poker hand by putting down cards onto the table. And you put down a card, and then you draw a card, and then you put down a card, and you draw a card. And if you get to a point where you cannot legally make a poker hand, then you're basically busted out, you sweep everything into a discard pile, and then it's the other person's turn. If you can make a poker hand, you basically send it over to the other player. They then begin to block using cards from their hand.
Color me intrigued. Be quiet. I want to play this.
All right.
So I don't want to hear anymore.
We will play it together, and then we'll discuss it on a future episode. And I will leave the discussion there.
Yeah.
I will say this. I was having a really good time. It's a neat little take on poker. I sat down with the two oldest kids, Chloe and Carlos, 7 and 9 respectively, and we played Descent with the App.
Nice. Like you said, you were going to do last episode.
Yes.
Follow through, people. That's what you get here on the FMD podcast. Follow through.
It was fun. We were having a good time. You can tell that this game was not originally designed for the app because it's not nearly as good an experience as it is with Mansions of Madness. And I don't say that to be negative. I just say that because...
it's the truth.
Well, yeah. And they took a good idea and ran with it best that they could. But it feels a little clunky. It feels clunky when I put it next to Mansions of Madness, which was designed for the ground up for an app, and it shows. Despite the semi-crunchiness of the Descent rule set, the kids were able to grasp it, and they were doing really, really well. And all I had to do was kind of help them with some of the crunch here and there and to remind them of some of the things that their characters could do outside of the norm. I'm looking forward to doing it again, and I think they're really going to kind of glob onto it. And I think we're going to do a campaign, which will be fun.
There you go. That sounds awesome.
So, Robert and I were lucky enough to receive a review copy of Blood Bowl from Games Workshop, so you can definitely look on that.
Thank you, Freebooters.
Yes, thank you, Freebooters. Thank you, Games Workshop.
Yes.
So, yeah, we did receive a review copy of Blood Bowl, and it looks, just at first glance, opening up the box, it just looks amazing. The models on the sprues are so well detailed.
Yeah, that's the thing that really, really turned me off. I worked at a game store in college, and one of the things they would do is they would run a league of this game. Yeah, it was just the thing. I didn't like the old models. The old models look kind of goofy. It was like it's a football player, but he's got like a dagger, so it's fantasy. But I called dibs on the orcs this time around.
That's fine. I say we trade back and forth a little bit. Try both out.
We can try both that. I'm keeping the orcs. I'm gonna paint them, and they're gonna be red because it makes them go faster. But the models, they have a much more fantasy vibe, especially the orcs, because the orcs,
yeah,
it kind of does that thing that they did in the armor for the Lord of the Rings movies, where it's not so much refined armor, it's just kind of like pieces of metal that they sort of fashion an armor vaguely. I'm really looking forward to it, and I actually started looking at the dwarf models. Because they don't have gnomes in Games Workshop World, which is my true love. But they got dwarves, which is, they're almost like gnomes, except with axes.
And beards.
And not pointy hats. Sometimes gnomes have beards.
But they're tiny little beards, because they're tiny little people.
Well, David the gnome had a big beard relative to his size. But no, the models look good. I haven't read the rules yet. It'll be interesting for me. I am one of those nerds that does not know much about the sports ball. So trying to play a football-based board game will be kind of weird for me, because I literally know next to nothing about football. It's all vague recollections of high school.
Yeah, so the rule set lies somewhere between American football and rugby.
Except it's more violent, because I know one of the dwarf units you used to get was a dude driving like a giant spinning wheel or cylinder of death.
Wheel. It's basically like if they allowed murder in rugby and football, you'd get Blood Bowl.
Yeah, and it looks like they did the right thing. They made the minis cooler and kept the rules the same, which is all anybody really wanted who played that game, from what I understand.
Yeah, well, and I'll tell you, my initial impression of that box is that at $100, it's actually a startling value. This box is pretty neat. You get two full teams, you get a pitch on a really thick cardstock board, and you get all of the...
you get the two rule books.
Yeah, you get the two rule books.
I like the little minor detail. They had that weird advertisement thing that was the big giant piece of paper. But it was there mainly, it was there to be an advertisement, but it was there mainly to protect the books and the stuff from the sprues scratching them up, which was awesome.
Yeah, so in the box, you get the first thing you see when you open up the box are the models on the sprue, and the sprue has a lot of really sharp edges on it.
Well,
and
it's orcs, they got pointy bits.
Yep. And so they put this very thick cardstock advertisement between the sprues and the fiddly bits of the game. So the board, the dice, and all the other stuff. And it basically acts as a really nice protection from the models. And I was really impressed by that. It really is nice.
Yeah, and the thing was a bit thrashed.
And that's just from shipping.
Yeah, the orcs just had tried to murder it a little bit. So yeah, no, it was a good call on their part. So the rule books,
The rule books look great. The cards, get the pitch, you get the dice, and most importantly, you get another sprue that has nothing but tools on it. including a really neat measuring stick that lets you determine the length of a pass. Blood Bowl looks awesome. I really can't wait to dig into it and get it out on the table.
Speaking of another Kickstarter that you got in, you just got in with that, the Dresden Files card game.
Yes, which I have played. I actually had an opportunity to play the Dresden Files card game about 6-7 months ago. It's super fun. It's got this really great mechanic where you store up what amounts to action or magic points, and then as you spend them, they get expended, and you move those points physically into a second area of the game, and then you have to take time to rebuild your stores, and then you move them back into the ready area. And it's this neat push-pull with the magic.
It sounds like fun.
Especially since every single adventure is based on one of the books. So it's a cooperative adventure card game, and it's my experience, it was super fun. And that's what we've had off the shelf. What have you had off the shelf? We can't wait to hear from you. Hop online and go to any of our digital outlets and let us know what you've been playing.
And next up is the Wisdom of Crowds, where we have a little bit of news and a lot of bit of Kickstarter.
Right after this short break. And now a quick message from one of our sponsors, the Freebooters Network. And one of the great shows on the Freebooters Network is, of course, 40K Radio. And in advance of the first anniversary of the new 40K Radio team, you are being invited to the Lords of Change subscription drive. So this is a subscription drive all about getting the Freebooters Network subscription numbers up on iTunes. And so make sure you go to iTunes, subscribe, like, and share as soon as possible. This is a fantastic prize pack. And the greatest thing is it's going to grow based on the number of subscriptions. So right now, the prize is a Graham McNeil signed copy of Wrath of Magnus, which is an awesome 40K model. And every additional 100 Freebooter subscriptions will get more added to the prize pack. So at 100 subscribers, you get the Thousand Suns Rubric Marines, all the way up to 1,000 subscribers, where we get Magnus the Red. Of course, that would happen at 1,000. So, one person's going to win the entire Lord of Change bag of goodies, but to do so, you're going to need to subscribe, like, and share as soon as possible, and to make this prize pack all that it can be, make sure you're telling all your friends about it as well.
Captain, come in! It's a war zone out here! The trolls are about to overrun our position! There's casualties everywhere! No one can have a decent conversation without exploding into flame wars! I understand, sir. The other Mont and I are trying to hold them back, but no matter how many we ban, they just keep coming back in greater numbers! Captain, tell my wife. Free Buddhist Forums. A great place to chat with no trolls and no BS. All gaming, all the time. www.freebuddhas.com.
And now it's time for our Wisdom of Crowds, our bi-weekly tabletop news and Kickstarter section. And unfortunately, Robert, we're still a little bit light on news.
We were kind of heavy last time, so maybe everybody got everything out at the beginning of the month, and then...
Well, we're kind of in that weird funk, you know, Gen Con's not that far off, and you know that the road to Gen Con is littered with PR, so we'll have plenty of news very soon.
We're recording this on at the end of February, so maybe March is the go date. So, like, March 1st, all this stuff comes out, and then, you know, our podcast will come out in, like, sometime between the 7th and the 10th or whatever, and we'll just be like, there's no news, and, like, all the people out there will be like, there's tons of news, what are you talking about? It's like... The delay.
There is a slight delay.
Yeah.
But that's it. The first thing on our news is actually something that you and I are both heavily interested and invested in, and that is a brand new faction for Hordes.
At SmogCon this year, which I found out will soon be renamed Lock and Load Europe. But anyway, this past SmogCon, they released a video of the new faction, and it's got a really interesting take. It wasn't what I was expecting, because everybody was expecting, like, demons. But this had more of, like, a weird, like, fairy tale vibe, almost. It reminded me a lot, actually. Everybody's got their thing it reminds them of. It reminded me a lot of an old Ravenloft module I read called The Nightmare Lands. Because it's all about these weirdos who existed in, like, the spirit world. And they've become more, like, of ideas than people. And now they've been unleashed again on the world by the old witch, who is a Cadoran warcaster currently in the game. And so she released these, they're called the Defiers, back on the Earth to hold off paying the price, which no one quite knows what that means. It's implied that it's the price for magic, which we're not going to go into the weeds of the Iron Kingdom's lore at this point. But yeah. But so Old Witch is also going to be a warlock for this faction, and she's also going to be a Cadoran Warcaster. And instead of it being like both, like she has the same rules for both, she's actually going to have two separate cards.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, so it'll
be a departure from their previous.
It makes sense because of the focus and the theory. Yeah. They've said pretty much that it's going to be Epic Old Witch will be the Cadoran Warcaster, and then Epic Old Witch 2 will be the Grimkin. By the way, we're talking about the Grimkin.
Yeah, the Grimkin is the name of the new faction, and they really look neat. And I got to tell you, the first thing that jumped right out is how unique, even within the Iron Kingdoms, the art style that they use to show them off is.
Yeah, like I said, it's got this really airy, dreamy, nightmarish quality about them, because they, besides the Old Witch, they've got five Warcasters. And they talked a lot about a lot of them, and then now the only one whose name I can remember is the King of Nothing, which they didn't show off at all, but they showed this old guy sitting in a tree with apples on it. I'm like, that's just cool. The whole faction just looks crazy. They're heavy war beasts. One of them's like stitched together with, it's like muscle with bits of, it's carved off of people, like the,
yeah,
like the Jeepers Creepers monster. But
it's like the concept of Frankenstein, except at a much chunkier level, rather than whole limbs, it's individual little pieces.
And a lot of faces. There's a lot of faces.
Yeah, a lot of faces. It is a rather unsettling critter.
And then the other heavy war beast they got looks like straight out of Silent Hill.
Yeah, that guy looks awesome.
So, yeah, there's just a lot of... It's channeling a lot of stuff. The Grimkin, basically like gremlins in the Iron Kingdoms are related to them, but this is like, you know, way up the food chain, because the gremlins are way down on the food chain of the Grimkin, so...
I do have to say, I have a slight reservation, and that's just because it just doesn't seem to click into the world based on everything else that we've seen. And you know, who knows, right? We're only seeing preview stuff, and we'll have to see how it really does fit in. But the art style's different.
Yeah.
The everything about the faction is different. They just seem so far removed.
They say the way that they're going to fit... Well, for one, they're a limited faction like Convergence. So they're going to get their round of releases, and then that'll sort of be that. Going a really bizarre different route, I don't think is a bad idea. And like I said, it's got this like weird fairy tale, dark evil fairies vibe thing going on. So I don't know. I'm appreciating it for what it is, which is the models look cool. So that's kind of all I care about.
And the models do look really cool.
On a similar note, we're going to find out the rules of these guys next week, March 6th. We should have the rules for all these guys. So by the time this comes out, it'll either... They'll probably be out already.
Yeah, they'll be out. And we'll probably discuss them on the next episode.
But yeah. The Community Integrated Development System, which we talked about in a previous episode, which is their response. If you listen to our Mark III review, we mentioned there were a lot of little things with rules that they got wrong. And we mentioned like they should totally do something like they do at Magic, where they just give the new set to pro Magic players and say, try to break this. Well, their response to that is just release everything as like a beta packet 3 to 6 months early and let people try to break it then. And then when the models...
And let's face it, they will.
Yeah.
They will.
Yeah. But when the models officially release, they will have crowdsourced balance on them, which is probably a good thing, which is also why there's not going to be cards and models anymore and all that jazz, which kind of is sad, but whatever.
It's sad, but I mean, at this point, with the constantly evolving meta of games like this, games like X-Wing, games like, you know, Warhammer, it makes sense to go all digital. It's actually an impedance to the balance and the health of the game to be tied down to these physical cards at this point.
Yeah, truth. And as a part of that, Privateer Press, they haven't been exactly clear on how much they're going to do this, but they are closing down their forums as of March 1st, and they will be down until basically the 6th when the new stuff gets released. And they are going to redo their forums at that point. And they said they're going to cut some of the forum topics and condense them. Now, what that means, I don't know. But they said, you know, a lot of what we talk about is in the realm of social media now. So they might be kind of at least halfway joining Wizards and BioWare.
Yeah, I was going to say that's very similar to what Wizards did a while back. Well, moving on, we've also got some news that you're super excited about. This is definitely something you brought forward, and that is Tales from the Yawning Portal is getting some more details.
Yeah, so I've been listening to Wizards Dragon Talk podcast. One of the segments they have is they have kind of like a lore segment that they have. Lately, they've been talking about Tales from the Yawning Portal because they've been, you know, collecting adventures from all over. So two things. The most recent podcast let loose that... When we talked about this a couple episodes ago, they said that they're going to do Against the Giants. And I said, I don't know if that means they're going to do all of Against the Giants or if they're just going to do the Steeding of the Hill Giant Chief. And I kind of thought that they would only do one. But no, apparently the Against the Giants chapter is Against the Giants. It is the three classic modules. The Steeding of the Hill Giant Chief, the Glacial Rift of the Frost Giant Jarl, and then the Hall of the Fire Giant King. So yeah, that chapter is going to be three adventures for the price of one. It's going to be all three of those dungeons, you know, together. And also they said the loose storyline that is going to be connecting all these adventures together is like that Batman episode where, you know, I think it's called They Almost Got Him, where all the villains are sitting around playing poker and talking about all the times they almost killed Batman. So it's like your adventures in the bar, the Yawning Portal bar, talking about that time, or at least if all of you die, adventuring group you heard about while you're sitting in the Yawning Portal. So I think that's kind of funny. It's an interesting way to string a campaign together where, you know, mm-hmm. you start the session off with people drinking and sharing and swapping stories. And then they also said that the capstone to that entire book, which was the Tomb of Horrors, which is the old school module that was designed to murder the heck out of your players.
Yeah, we've talked about that one before.
Yeah, they said, quote, it's a faithful adaptation, which means, yes, gentle listeners,
you're all gonna die.
that module invented the phrase make a save or die.
Total party sweep. What?
Yep. So what they were talking about, one of the traps is you're in a hallway, and in the hallway you get trapped in the hallway and it fills up with gas and you fall asleep, and then a thing that crushes the life out of you, like the boulder in Indiana Jones, I think it's just a crushing like cylinder that fills the entire quarter, crushes your sleeping body. So all you know as a player is you fall asleep and you have to tear up your character sheet because they died in their sleep somehow.
That's terrible.
Which makes a fun story. I don't know if I've actually invested a character from levels 1 to 14 and I walk into the Tomb of Horrors and just happen to get, like, just crushed while I pass out. I don't know how satisfying that would be to me, but it makes a good story for later.
Yeah, it does.
So this next one came from something you insisted we put in. All right, Jonathan, tell us about Big Trouble in Little China, the board game.
Yes, it's getting a board game. Number one, it's got epic-looking little miniatures, and everybody's there. There's Jack Burton, All the Storms, Lo Pan, the Chinese Wild Man, and Pete, who is the critter that pulls Gracie Law into the wall.
There's not much about the board game on the website.
No,
which,
if you
look at our handy show notes, I will have a link in there, people.
I can tell you a little bit. It's going to have a double-sided board with a top-down perspective, kind of similar to, say, like a Descent or...
Makes sense.
Ninja Turtles or one of those, right? The minis will move around the board, of course. It's going to be cooperative, and it's going to be primarily dice-driven. And the dice actions are going to be all based on cooperative mechanics. So that makes me wonder if it's going to have some similar functions like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles board game, which has a great co-op dice mechanic where you actually share dice, like the turtles would be sharing skills. And just everything about it just makes it seem like it's going to be a riff off of Descent, but with a full co-op.
And hopefully more kung fu.
So it's being developed by a company called Boom with an exclamation point Studios.
Oh, that's a comic company.
Yeah. And it's being published by Everything Epic, who I don't know a ton about. It's coming later in 2017. I'm sure that we'll start to see a lot more as it gets a bit closer to Gen Con. The really nice thing is that they've already said not coming to Kickstarter, is going straight to market, which is awesome. So I'm really excited about it. We'll have to see how it goes.
And that probably means very much a Gen Con release.
Big Trouble in Little China, hopefully coming real soon. Now moving out of the regular news and into Kickstarter, and there's actually quite a bit of interesting Kickstarter news out there right now. AEG has thrown Thunderstone Quest up to Kickstarter.
Has Thunderstone ever been on Kickstarter before?
No. Looking at the Kickstarter page, this is AEG's very, very first Kickstarter.
Interesting. So tell us all about the Thunderstones.
Well, it's a campaign-based adventure game. It's card-based. Just based on what I see here, it seems like it's going to be very similar to like a Warhammer Quest or an Arkham Adventure card game. Certainly not quite the same mechanics. There's definitely some different mechanics, but that's the basic idea. It's a card-driven questing game for co-op playing. What's interesting is it does have a dice mechanic with it, because you do get a bunch of six-sided dice with it. So the basic mode of the game is competitive, but they're also talking about how there's going to be a co-op and a solo mode. So that kind of puts it in line. The original Thunderstone was a deck builder, as I recall. So it'll be basically built around the same concepts, but they're taking it in some different directions and adding the quest element, which is the big major change. So the Thunderstone Quest Kickstarter is actually doing quite well. It's already at $275,000 of its $50,000 goal. So guess what? We're getting it.
Yes, for sure we are.
And now the interesting thing is it's averaging just shy of $100 per pledge.
Because the sweet spot pledge is where? Probably $100?
Well, okay, so it's got two different pledge levels. A $60 adventure pledge level that comes with base game, dividers for card management, the dungeon wilderness tile, quest number one, which is 243 cards and a bunch of other stuff that supports it, and all unlock stretch goals. The $100 tier is the base game, the dividers, the dungeon wilderness tile, and then you get three quests, and that's $100. Basically, what it's saying is that everybody's opting for the $100 pledge.
Next up is My Neck of the Woods.
Oh, it's a sequel to Mutant Year Zero.
Yeah, so Free Legion, the Free League, makers of such fine role-playing games as Mutant and Tales from the Loop, they have got a sequel to their Mutant game called Mutant Mechatron.
I love the cover on this game. It looks so good.
It's the same guy from Tales from the Loop, actually.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. But, I mean, just that cover image is just so striking. It's a beautiful image.
Yeah, the robot walking through the ruins.
Yeah. And he's holding up the skull.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Shakespeare, man. Shakespeare.
Oh, total Shakespeare.
It is its own thing.
This Meatbag, I knew thee well.
Meatbag, I knew so this game is its own thing. You do not need the original Mutant game to play. This is self-contained. And it tells the story of the Hive, which is where these robots come from. And you can definitely play it with Mutant Year Zero. And they have rules for, like, crossovers and stuff. But this is its own game. What sounded interesting to me is when you build your robot character, you actually build it by parts. So I'm wondering if, like, you know, part of character creation is, like, head, shoulders, knees, and toes, you know? Like, it's like, oh, I'll have freaking blasters for arms, and I'll have a couple of wheels, yes! And, you know, I'll make myself Johnny Five!
I like the guy that they've got, who's got a pistol in one hand, and then his second arm is basically a giant shoulder cannon.
Exactly.
He's pretty awesome looking.
So it's going to come with a complete campaign called Ghost in the Machine. And yeah, it's its own thing. It sounds fun. And I like this because it expands on the world, but you don't have to really want or care the other thing. If you just want to play post-apocalyptic robot city guys, that sounds appealing. But playing mutants in the, you know, Mad Maxian waste doesn't sound appealing to you. Just buy this game and ignore the other one. That's all you got to do.
Yeah, the art that they show off in the Kickstarter is absolutely gorgeous. From the cover image on down to the images of the robots that they've built, there's some really good stuff here. And it does seem like you were saying that the part of the character creation is basically constructing your robot, which is awesome. There's also some pretty interesting images here that lead me to believe that there is going to be a distinctly human element to the included story. They've got one image of a guy with a rifle and some kind of like shock machine leading a bunch of robots on leashes. There's a lot of malice in the image. It's interesting.
It is post-apocalypse, so can you imagine if there was, like, you know, robots that he could enslave, what a Morton Joe would do? I mean, that's not too far off the mark, so.
Yeah. This is doing really, really well so far. It's at 77,000 of a goal of 11,000. So it's just about to pass the 1,000 backer stage with 23 days left. Pledge levels are pretty straightforward. Most of them are in SEK, which is the Swedish currency, but they are translated by Kickstarter into dollars. $28 for your basic. You get the Mutant Mechatron core book in PDF only. For $39, you get the printed format of the book and the PDF. And then for $67, you get the book, the PDF, and all physical printed stretch goals and all PDFs that are unlocked. And then it just goes on from there. It looks like most people are opting for the physical version of the book, interestingly enough.
I'm not shocked. I usually get the physical version of the book because I like having the book there if I'm running it. So that is Mutant Mechatron by Free Legion, the Free League.
Now we move on to something that I've been really looking forward to, and that is GKR Heavy Hitters, Giant Killer Robots. And this, of course, is the game that the models are being made by Weta Workshop, who is, of course, the famous folks behind the special effects for Lord of the Rings, special effects for...
Oh, they worked on everything.
Yeah, they've worked on so much stuff.
I think they did some stuff for Avatar, and they get farmed stuff a lot, even if it's just a few shots.
They are really good at what they do.
True.
And there's a lot of really neat videos showing off these models online, and they're worth a watch.
One thing I really do like about this is Giant Killer Robots is living up to its name. The Giant Killer, it's not like Battletech where it's like, yes, these colossal mechs do battle on the battlefield. They are 38 millimeters tall.
Yeah, these are big models.
Yeah, Giant Killer Robots, yeah, they are pretty big. I mean, they have a soda can for the totally not Pepsi that is part of the lore of the setting. I think it's called, is it Hepsi? It's totally not Pepsi, which is the point. Anyway, they're much larger than that soda can that they put everything next to, so it's a large model. And the robots have a different look to them, which I also thought was pretty cool because...
They're surprisingly... I want to say almost realistic.
Yeah.
There's a certain real-lifeness to them.
Like an industrial look.
Yeah, like these look like machines that you would evolve the robots that build cars into.
Yeah, yeah. So
they've got those spindly limbs and all kinds of hooks and different apparatus. It totally reminds me of the same vibe that you get from Chappie.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, actually. I was about to say that out loud.
Now, one of the things that I really like about it is the board is actually rather three-dimensional. So the majority of the art on the board is crumpled buildings, but then you actually have buildings that you can place down, and these are skyscraper-sized. So they tower above the giant killer robots, and there's cover rules and whatnot that are engaged in it. The majority of the movement is handled by hexes, which are printed on the board, and then the bases that the robots are on are hexes as well. And when you see everything laid out with the buildings in 3D, you know what? This game is a looker. So gameplay is a couple different phases, and I do have to kind of spend a moment really talking about how good this Kickstarter page is. They really did a good job of explaining the game, showing off the game, and making it.
Well, they've been doing a good job in marketing. I was looking at the Beasts of War page because they went to SmogCon, and they were also really heavily promoting this game. They have a lot of videos playing this game. So they're doing a good job of at least getting it out there. And I watched a bit of the gameplay. I didn't watch the whole thing because the first video of the series was over an hour long. But yeah, I was watching them set up the board, and they were talking about rolling dice, and it seemed pretty straightforward. So. Yeah.
I mean, basically, you have a deployment phase where you deploy your support units onto the field.
The support units are these little, when I say robots. Little, they're more like the stupid sky tank from Terminator, you know. I mean, in real life, that's the size of it, but yep. Yeah, it's much smaller than your main robot, little things that fly around the board and do stuff.
Then you get your movement phase where everybody gets to move around the field. That leads into combat, where it's a dice-driven combat. And there's all kinds of stuff. There's energy weapons, missile weapons, ballistic weapons, all kinds of fun stuff.
And there's different pilots you can take that all have different skills. And that's one of
I really like, because that's the modifier of the pilot and the robot gives you a lot of different combinations.
Right, right. And then part of the stretch goals is, I think last time I checked, they unlocked three new pilots on top of the four that were going to come with the base game. So that's a lot more variation and replayability right there.
After combat, you get a phase called tagging, where you actually assert dominance on the battlefield by placing tags on buildings that you demolish. And it's kind of interesting because it's almost like it wants you to just destroy the...
Well, the fluff is that, you know, the world has had some sort of horrible calamity, and, you know, they have to destroy all these, like, burned-out husks of cities to rebuild. Why not make it into a sport where giant robots do the demolishing and fight each other and get some good TV ratings and make some money?
So the core box is $100. You get four fully painted heavy hitters. These are the largest of the robots. And mind you, these models are gigantic. Then you get 12 support units, so three per giant killer robot. And then you get all the assorted cards and tableaus, and then the 3D terrain, which is you get 10 buildings, which you construct out of cardboard, and they look really, really good.
I think they unlocked a bonus one on the stretch goals, too.
Awesome, even better. And then you get 16 different pilots. That's huge.
Oh, it's 16?
Yes.
Oh, my.
So that's a lot of variation there. That's good stuff. They do have a $125 version, which is called the Pilots Edition, and you actually do get pilots as well, minis for the pilots.
Which I don't know what those do, besides look cool, but I don't know. They're miniatures. Of course they're supposed to be there to look cool.
Yep. And then you get there's also the $150 Painter's Edition. That's the Pilots Edition plus four unpainted heavy hitter models. They're unassembled, they're easy to paint, and you still get all the applicable stretch goals. That's on top of everything else in the Pilot Edition. And the neat thing is that version lets you do a lot of customization. And I'm looking at some of the customizations that other people have done here on the Kickstarter page, and it looks amazing.
That is GKR, Giant Killer Robots, by Weta and Cryptozoic. So, Jonathan, tell us about Empires of the Void Part 2.
So, if you've ever heard anything from my old show or anything from this show, you'll know one of my most favorite designers is Ryan Lockett. And I have all of his games with the exception of one, and that is Empires of the Void, because it's been out of print for a long time, and I didn't find out about Ryan Lockett until after it was out of print. And I just have a really hard time paying six times the normal cost of a game for something on eBay just because it's out of print. That hurts.
Hashtag first world problems.
True. Ryan Lockett's a really good designer. He makes these really interesting worlds. He makes beautiful games. And he's kind of unique because he's a triple threat. He does all of the art for the games himself. He does all of the storylines for the games himself. He does all of the components. He does all the game design. He does every aspect of it. And so what you end up with are these really cohesive packages where the gameplay and the art and every aspect of it meld together into these very interesting, unique worlds.
Nice.
And he has frog people, and that makes me happy because they're awesome looking. So the one game that I've never been able to get my hands on is Empires of the Void, and he's now producing Empires of the Void 2. And it's
please tell me it's subtitled Electric Boogaloo.
No, sadly not.
Aw.
It's a riff off of a 4X game. Now, it's just done really, really, really well so far. It just went up this morning, and it's already at 111,000. 24 days left to go. Here's the best thing about it. One pledge level. Only one. $60, you get the game. That's it. No more.
So that is Empires of the Void 2. Electric Boogaloo. Not Electric Boogaloo.
Not Electric Boogaloo. Now, next up on our list is something that you are super excited about, and we've actually talked a lot about this lately.
Yes, we have. Well, I busted out the miniatures lately because I need my sci-fi miniatures.
We're talking about Relic Knights 2nd Edition.
So, yes, Relic Knights is back on Kickstarter. This Kickstarter went live today, and if you hear this podcast and it's relatively soon to its release date, like, go jump on this like it's made out of ham, because this was a 15-day Kickstarter, so the clock is ticking. By the time this comes out, you will probably, at best, have
about
5 days
a week.
Yeah, a week to 5 days. They wanted $50,000. They are currently sitting pretty at $91,000. So this is going to fund. The second edition, they're doing what they did for Dystopian Wars. Dystopian Wars, basically what they wanted to make was a new two-player starter, and then they started adding more models into it. So the two-player starter is Radiant versus Void. Basically, there's six main factions in the Relic Knights universe, and three of them work for the Void, and three of them work for the Radiant faction. And so Radiant and Void, you can think of as like the mercenary factions. Their models can be included in any, you know, if you're a Radiant faction, you can get Radiant models. And if you're a Void faction, you can get Void models, or you can just, you know, I have Black Diamond, which was a Void faction, so I could take Black Diamond models, I can take Void models, yada yada yada. As part of this Kickstarter, you can get the original models. They're also going to have a conversion kit, which will give you all the cards and everything you need to update your first edition stuff to the second edition stuff. And it looks like the game has had some subtle changes. The Esper deck looks different. It doesn't use dice like most miniature games. It uses a deck of cards with sort of six quote-unquote mana colors like Magic the Gathering has. And, you know, you just need a certain number of colors to fuel your abilities.
I do like what comes in the starter box here. It's a really nice, attractive package. It's got a really beautiful top-down board that has some great art on it, some nice lighting effects on it. And then it comes with 3D scenery, which is cool.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to use a lot of terrain. I remember that from the original one. You have a lot of terrain. One thing they were doing, which was really cool in the last Kickstarter, was they're stealing a page from Kingdom Death, and they're going to have some pinup models. So, shall we say more fan service-y models are going to be part of this, which, given it's a miniature game that's sort of based off of anime tropes, so having fan service-y stuff, I'm not terribly shocked. The other thing they're doing is, which they did in the original Kickstarter, is they're releasing Dark Space models. And what Dark Space models are is, it's basically like alternate universe models. So what they do is they take an existing model. For example, in the original edition, there was a model in the Space Pirates faction, the Star Corsairs, called Iron Chef. And his normal model is him in a chef's outfit with a frying pan that he goes and beats people up with. One of the stretch goals they unlocked was Dark Space Iron Chef, where they put him in a Solid Snake costume from, you know, the Metal Gear games, and he ended up working for Black Diamond. So that's what they're doing. They're basically switching. It's like the evil parallel goateed version of of the stuff. And it's of existing models that are in other factions. So they've already unlocked a few of them. So we've got Dark Space Squall, Dark Space Jacob, and Dark Space Kiza, which are all models that already exist in the game. Squall, I don't recognize. She's standing on a robot hand. And I don't recognize Jacob. I'm not getting what the reference is. But Dark Space Kiza, she looks like Felicia from the Darkstalkers video game. But yeah, all the models have this anime vibe. They're all based off of anime tropes.
It's doing really well. The Kickstarter backing levels are anywhere from $25 just for the pinups. $70 gets you the two-player starter box. And then it just goes up from there, getting you a bunch of extra stuff. Relic Knights, second edition. After a short break, we'll be back with our deep dive for the episode all about Planeshift Kaladesh, which, Robert, I know you're super excited to talk about.
Super excited. Super excited. Do you have a tabletop, board game, miniature game, or RPG that you're going to release for retail?
Or do you have an upcoming tabletop Kickstarter that you're about to launch?
We would love to interview you for a future episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Send us an email to fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com to schedule an interview. We love getting feedback, so please let us know how we're doing by doing one of the following.
You can email us at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/forgotmydice. We post all our articles there, so feel free to comment, or you can message us directly via the Facebook Messenger.
We also have Facebook comments enabled for all our posts at ForgotMyDice.com.
You can also message us or tweet us on the Twitter. Find us at ForgotMyDice.
You can join us on the Freebooter Network message boards. Find your way there by going to FreebootersNetwork.com and click on the Freebooters Forum.
If you like the show, the best way for more people to find out about us is to give the Freebooters Network a review on iTunes.
Lastly, for those of you listening from the depths of interstellar space, make sure you turn your controls 18 degrees to the left and flip the intensifier disc on and off again.
Interstellar space?
Yeah, they listen to podcasts on interocitors.
And now it's time for our deep dive. And on tonight's deep dive, we are going to be talking about Plane Shift Kaladesh. This is the latest version of WotC's Plane Shift series. And in this series, what they do is they take the Magic the Gathering plane and migrate it over into Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition rules, which is something that you and I have talked about a lot on the show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it took them... How long have they owned D&D? Like, oh, I just found this out the other day because we were talking about it on the Facebooks. Wizards bought D&D in 1997, and they owned Magic well before that, and they didn't do this until last year, 2016. So they owned it for 19 years.
Yeah, almost 20 years before they tried this.
Yeah.
And this just seems like a duh moment. It truly does.
Yeah,
did it take so long?
I've heard it's just the Magic team and the D&D team are kind of, they're separate, and, you know, it's just a lot of, like, people not wanting to play in each other's sandboxes, something like that. But lately, I've heard a lot that people have been kind of switching back and forth, and I know the marketing team for Magic is really heavily involved with the D&D storylines now, and they're sort of marketing them like Magic, and so I guess they got cross-pollinated enough that people were comfortable with playing each other's sandboxes.
And, you know, honestly, it's a natural fit.
Yeah,
well, it really truly is.
Also, it helps that the guy who writes these big, nifty art books, like the one I'm holding in my hot little hands, is James Wyatt, who...
And you're not joking about big. I mean, that art book is huge.
Yeah, but James Wyatt used to be on the D&D team. He used to do D&D stuff, and then he moved over to do fluff and whatnot in game design for Magic. But he came from a D&D background, and so that's why they task him with writing the Plane Shifts and writing these books. So yeah, the first one was Plane Shift Zendikar, and then they followed that up with Plane Shift Innistrad, and now they've followed that up with Plane Shift Kaladesh, and they have said as much that the next Magic set, Almanket, is going to get one as well. This is obviously a thing that is going to continue to happen for the foreseeable future, which is awesome, because we get like a very fairly fleshed out D&D setting.
And it's a beautiful supplement, too. It should be said. It uses all the Magic the Gathering art, and it's laid out very professionally. This is in no way, shape, or form a half-measured production. This is a full production value product, and what's fantastic about it is the size. It's a 33-page document, and it does really have everything that you need to get set up and start running this. So let's kind of break it down.
The original idea for Kaladesh was the follow-up for the last set. They knew there were going to be a lot of artifacts, and they had dropped a hint that the planeswalker Chundra had come from a plane called Kaladesh, and that's pretty much all that they had at this point. And they were thinking with artifacts, this time they wanted to do maybe a steampunk setting, but the problem was they'd already done Innistrad, which was their horror setting, and steampunk is kind of like foggy streets of London with gears and weirdness. But the problem is gothic horror is also foggy streets of London with gears and scary horror weirdness. And so they were like, we kind of already did this, the foggy streets, so we need to do something different, which is where they got the bright idea. It's like, well, why don't we take this plane that we mentioned, which is based loosely on India, and steampunk, and mash it together, and then instead of making it dark and creepy, make it colorful and, you know, Bollywood, I guess, would be a good way to describe it.
This is by far the, like you just said, the most colorful that we've ever seen Magic the Gathering get. It's beautiful. It's bright. It's vibrant in every way, shape, and form.
Yeah, they said what they were going for was making it hopeful, because steampunk has this kind of like nihilistic thing sometimes.
Yeah.
And also coming off of Innistrad, which was, you know, a horror-based set about people going insane and turning into tentacle monsters. They wanted to do something a little bit more hopeful and bright and colorful and cheery. And so, yeah, Kaladesh like nailed it.
And I think they sum it up in the first sentence of the PDF. Kaladesh is a living work of art, a vibrant, beautiful plane where anything is possible. And I think that really absolutely sums it up.
So the basic thing of the setting is there is this energy called ether, and ether flows through the sky in rivers. And unlike our world, where, you know, mountains and rivers and whatnot are part of a natural geologic process, that's not how things work in Kaladesh. The ground features actually follow the flows and streams of ether up in the sky, and so rivers get weird and very windy, and everything has this weird sort of spirally-ness to it.
Yes.
Because even, like, the trees want to catch the ether that falls from the sky, because ether's, like, kind of like a life force magic something. And so the trees get very spindly and long because they want to have a lot of surface area to, like, catch the ether rain that occasionally rains down. And even the animals at Kaladesh are kind of infused with this magic. Like, if you look at a lot of the art, they either have these weird spirals all over them. Like, they have a picture in the art book of this rhinoceros where it's just, it's you know, the rhinoceros have that big, thick hide. But this big, thick hide has just all these spirals, and its horns are very majestic. And other times they show, like, the Kaladesh dragon or the sky whales where they have a lot of glowy bits on them. And it's because they've just been eating and just bathing in this magic this whole time, and so they're drenched in it, they're covered with it, they are inherently a magical animal.
I gotta say that for me, it's the first setting that pulled me into the game, and I adore it. I think it's an amazing setting.
So in the setting, basically about 60 years ago, a inventor figured out a way to capture ether and refine it to make, like, you know, magic gas, basically. Like magic fuel. Magic diesel, we'll call it diesel. And they use that to power inventions, and that led to this renaissance of inventors. The main setting takes place mostly in a city called Garapur, which is kind of just vaguely go into it, but basically there were 11 kingdoms back in the day. They were warring with each other, and they would have, like, a lot of weird competitions. And one of the competitions they would have is they would have inventors that would invent things, and then they would have, like, you would go to visit a neighboring kingdom, and you would throw your adventures or your inventors at each other, and the inventors would have to invent something cool, and then you would judge them and then get bragging rights or something. But then after that was all said and done, these inventors would typically go and hang out together because, you know, it's like talk to a fellow engineer. And because of that, the inventors got really tight in all these kingdoms. And so when war broke out, it was actually the inventors that had lines of communication open that managed to make peace between these 11 kingdoms. And Garapur was the result of that. The inventors said, well, why don't you build a neutral city in all the territory that you guys are contesting, and then all of you can own it, and this can be kind of like your United Nations building where you can all go settle your disputes, and we can live there and invent stuff for everybody or whatever. Slowly but surely, that city took over all the kingdoms, and now the kingdoms are just gone, and it's all just Garapur, and the city is run by the consulate, which is basically Big Ether. I know I've used that phrase before, but they're the people who are in control of grabbing the ether and distributing it to the populace. And they're kind of like communist or Russian, you know, they try to distribute everything equally, but then, you know, it's kind of like how communist Russia got. Not everybody is as equal as others. So on the other side, So on the other side, you have the renegades. Now the consulate wants to tell you that the renegades are this organized force of rogue inventors that are up to no good. In reality, until the storyline of Ether Revolt, they were just people who are like, you know, ether should be for everybody, and we're trying to invent, and we only get this like little ration. We want more. And so renegades are basically people who steal ether to, you know, work on their own inventions and work on inventions that the consulate says aren't safe.
It's even more simple than that. I mean, it's basically anybody that expresses any opinion that is not in line with the consulate is considered a renegade. Because when you start reading through the backgrounds and affiliation chapter, it makes it very clear that there's only a couple of things that will fall into the consulate, and anything else is basically considered renegade.
Right. And the consulate, to an extent, like, allows the renegades to exist, because one of the things they do is they have night markets where they, you know, it's like a black market, essentially, where they sell stuff. They have Pokemon battles where they make artifact creatures that look like animals, and they battle each other. And the consulate allows that to an extent because even participates, because, you know, they realize that they need this. So what you've got is basically you've got a city full of intrigue. You've got groups that aren't necessarily aligned but have possibly similar goals, sort of messing around with and fighting, you know, the man that exists in the form of the consulate. And then the consulate sort of allows that infighting to exist because, you know, it needs an outlet to an extent. And sometimes the renegades come up with an invention that they're also like the OSHA of their, you know, universe. So when an invention is considered safe enough, they will take it and mass produce it. It's this weird push and pull. So the city's full of intrigue, and it's got a lot of really cool little details. My favorite one is there's a district of the city where the giants of Kaladesh, they migrate through these migrational paths that they've used for centuries, and one of them goes right through the center of the city. And so there's a district of the city that is literally like a bunch of bridges and stuff. And when the giants come to walk through the city, all the bridges, you know, pull back and just open up, and everything just opens up and everybody clears the way out of the way. These huge giants just walk through the city, and as long as their path is clear, they don't care. But if their path isn't clear, sometimes they rage and start destroying stuff like kaiju, which is awesome. There's just a lot of cool little details, and that's what's the beauty of any setting based off of Magic the Gathering. The feel and the art and the look of everything is really, really laid out for you, and you can get the vibe and everything so easily from all this. And the art book is perfect for that, even much more so than this PDF.
And I definitely want to differentiate between the art book and the Plane Shift document. A lot of the fluff that we've been discussing and a lot of the little details that we've just been discussing definitely comes from the art book. The art book explores the fluff and the world in a huge amount of detail.
In a great amount of detail.
The plane shift document is strictly a document that gives a little bit of fluff, but mostly it is how do you take the D&D tropes and ideas and migrate them into this world so that it all makes sense. And the reason I want to make that distinction is because we'll start breaking down this document now, and you're not going to hear about a lot of that fluff. I think to really be successful running one of these campaigns, you kind of have to combine all of these elements together.
Yeah, you could think of it like the art books are like the setting book, and then the plane shifts are the player's book.
Yeah,
it gives you the rules.
Really, really good way of looking at it.
Yeah, you get the rules to make your character in the plane shift, but whoever's running it probably needs to get the art book as well to run the game.
Yeah,
or agreed. Just needs to have absorbed it by playing enough magic. All right, so let's break down Planeshift Kaladesh.
It does start with a small description of the world, but it's a very high-level description. For the kind of detail that we've been going through, you'd really want to turn to the art book.
So now, the first thing that talks about rules is they talk about backgrounds, which are the backgrounds from the Player's Handbook of D&D.
Yeah.
And what I really liked about this, and what I really give him credit for, is this guy went through them and basically put an X through a couple of them, because part of Kaladesh is they do not talk about anything about their religion or gods or any of that, and it's almost like D&D-style gods don't exist. They say, like, the Acolyte background just doesn't work in this setting, and cross it off the list.
They really do a great job coming right out and saying it. Because religion is not a part of everyday life on Kaladesh, this background is not well suited for a Kaladesh campaign, period. That's it. That's all you get for the Acolyte.
But some of them, you know, work better. Like, they talk about being a noble, and the nobles of Kaladesh, like I said, those kingdoms are gone.
Yeah.
So they say, this background best represents a bureaucrat associated with the consulate. However, such a character could easily use his position to secretly aid the renegade cause. Yes, you get the benefits of being a noble, but then they drill down and tell you what is being a quote-unquote noble mean in Kaladesh, and it means more like you're a bureaucrat in this giant company.
I do want to come right out and say this document basically takes for granted that you've read through the player manual and that you understand the basic concepts of these different backgrounds. And the reason I bring that up is because it doesn't give you any context. It just says, here's how this would work within Kaladesh, but it doesn't tell you what this is. So you do need to have the player's handbook to really get the most out of this.
So next up is a section that talks about the classes, and this is a real interesting talking point. Kaladesh, the setting, goes way out of its way to say that wizards are very rare. They're so rare, in fact, most people don't see them.
And if they do, they're going to be afraid of them.
Yeah, they're almost a subject of myth. So what it straight up does is it says, like, for example, bards. Bards on Kaladesh would probably be seen as a particular form of mage, akin to a pyromancer. As such, they'd be subject to persecution of the consulate. Or clerics. Clerics do not exist on Kaladesh. Like, it starts going through the classes and putting a big fat X through them. This is a concept that used to be in 2nd edition D&D, and they kind of briefly touch on it in 3rd edition D&D, and then 4th and 5th they have just gotten rid of it and don't even talk about it. But the idea that you can, as a DM, possibly remove classes from the mix to have stuff fit your setting, because they also straight up say that the wizard class probably doesn't work for how Kaladesh thinks about mages, and that you should use the sorcerer class to make mages. It's a really interesting concept of thinking about your campaign. Like, when I was thinking about running Innistrad, I thought about cutting out several of the classes, specifically the bard and the wizard class, and I thought about replacing them with the warlord and the alchemist class from Insider, which is another thing, and then the beta for the artificer class that wizards has made. If you're doing world building, like, all of the classes of D&D come with their own tropes, which also come with their own problems.
Yep.
And I talked a little bit about this in my very, very, very first article, The White Mage. Clerics kind of inherently come with them that the gods exist in your world, and if you don't necessarily want the gods to absolutely exist in your world, cutting out the cleric might be a way to do that. The point is, this setting is the first setting since 4th edition that straight up says, you know what, if the theme of this setting is that magic is rare, and as such, we are going to cut some classes because they just don't really work in this campaign. So obviously the barbarian's still around, the rogue, the fighter. They say monks don't exist.
Yeah. What I really like about this decision is it shows an absolute respect of the source material, that it's willing to sacrifice large chunks of the Dungeons & Dragons model for the sake of creating a world that fits within the one they've created. And I think that was an excellent decision, and it makes me that much more excited about the Plane Shift document, because it does it right. You know, it doesn't sacrifice anything just to make D&D work.
And here's the thing, as the DM, if you don't agree with this, then ignore
it. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the thing about being a DM, right? The DM GM's word is final at the end of the day. You know, anything that you don't agree with, if you want to override it, do it.
And also, this brings us to the first bit of brand new content in this document. They give you a sorcerer origin of the pyromancer, like Chundra. I mean, it's short, it's to the point, doesn't really give you much fluff. It just basically says you're a fire wizard, like our fire wizard character. But you get a new sorcerer's origin, which is you just cast fire good. It was one of the things I complained about in the Zendikar review.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they said Nahiri was a lithomancer, but they don't give us what a rock wizard is. And now they're saying it's like, oh, well, Chundra is a fire wizard. And now they give you what a fire wizard is, or a fire mage.
Gotta love that 18th level talent, by the way. You gain immunity from fire damage. Period. You're just immune to fire.
In addition, any spell or effect you create ignores resistance to fire damage and treats immunity to fire damage as resistance to fire damage. So take that, Red Dragon. You're going to burn anyway. So, and that brings us to the main rules divergence that this packet tries to address. And I think it's probably the packet's only real miss, which is the Aether-Powered Devices chapter.
Before we talk about the miss, let's talk about what it does really well. And the first thing that it does is how it handles items that have a magic charge. So, say, for instance, a wand that can cast 3 times in a day.
Sometimes the staves, like, it's like, this staff has 15 charges. You can use this ability for 1 charge, this ability for 2, and this ability for 3, and any number you want.
So in this setting, what it basically says is everything works roughly the same way, except that instead you're burning Aether.
When your weapons recharge at, like, dawn or whenever it says they recharge, as described in the DM's handbook.
You basically need to use refined Aether to recharge your weapon, and if you don't have any lying around, you can buy some for 50 gold.
It takes the concept of what Aether is in the Kaladesh setting and then kind of just says, hand waves it mostly, and says this is how it kind of works in this setting. You can get as weird with it as you want. It kind of just says, if you don't want to deal with this, like having people buy Aether, you can just say, well, when you recharge it for 1d6 charges, that it, you just basically find 1d6, you know, gallons or whatever of Aether to pour into your wand. And that's it. It's just this random amount that you manage to find. But if you want to get into the nitty gritty of it and allow people to recharge magic items at will, you could also just have them, buy it, go out and have to, like, get their ration.
I appreciate that it doesn't add crunchiness to the system.
It takes the existing magic item concept.
Yeah.
And then, you know, applies the setting rules to it.
Yeah, it riffs on it for the sake of the setting, and it works. It works really, really well. But
the part of it that's a miss a little bit is just that at that point it gets into inventing them. And basically how it works is you get a tool proficiency and you can use it to create magic items. Now, given the rules for creating magic items in the DMG itself are kind of vague and ill-defined, so James didn't have much to build on here. But just reading through these rules about how to build magic items and generally how it happens, to me, felt like a beta packet. Like, the rules just needed to coalesce a little bit more. They weren't quite there. It's something
They're undefined.
Yeah.
They don't do a very good job of giving you a full structure to work off of, and it's the only part of this packet that to me felt like it comes up short.
Which is to say, I think most people, if they really get into this, will probably end up house ruling this eventually.
Yeah.
So, next section, they talk a little bit about a Kaladesh campaign, which is basically, it's a page, which talks a little bit about the Aether Revolt, talks a little bit about just running, you know, a city full of intrigue, and it talks a very little bit about the wilderness surrounding the main city. And that's pretty much all you get. Like, there's not much there.
You can basically take any campaign setting or any campaign idea that you've ever had or borrowed from a book. I think if you're going to be a really good DM, you would then need to take that and equip it with knowledge from the art book.
Yeah, it's kind of more pointing you at, like, this is how you can use these sections of the art book to flesh out some adventure.
I think it does a really, really nice job of giving you a very high-level interpretation, but there's no detail here. And if you really want to run a successful Kaladesh campaign, I really do think you need that art book.
Right. So next up is more new game material, which is the races of Kaladesh. And first up is my favorite, which is the Aetherborn. So basically, refining Aether has a byproduct, but instead of, like, you know, noxious fumes or anything that we have when we refine gas in our world, refining Aether occasionally just spontaneously creates life, which are the Aetherborn. The Aetherborn live anywhere from a few weeks to a few years. 4 seems to be the max. They're very into hedonism. They're very into whatever. They have their own society. The chapter on them in the book is really interesting to read. And this book basically, you know, it, like everything, it gives you sort of a more high-level view. basically says probably go read that art book, because the section on Aetherborn in the book is, I think, 5 or 6 pages, and it goes into it in much more detail. Just giving you the D&D stats for these guys is cool, because the idea of having a race that has a very limited time frame, and that's the thing, too, that they talk about in the book much more so than this packet. The Aetherborn are pretty much aware to the minute of how much time they have left. Like, the clock is ticking in their head constantly, and they can feel it at all times.
That would make for such a compelling plot device, and that would also make for such a compelling character development device. It's such a neat concept.
Especially because sometimes the Aetherborn can figure out how to suck the life force out of other people to extend their own life, which they call the gift of the Aetherborn. But it's kind of more of a curse. The game mechanics on this are kind of vague and ill-defined, which is probably for the best, because giving your players the ability to become vampires is probably a dark space you may not necessarily want to go to, and it's more of a plot device anyway. Next up are the Kaladesh Dwarves, which mainly have the rules for the for Hill Dwarves from the Player's Handbook. There aren't any sub-races. It's kind of your generic dwarf.
Yeah, and if anything, I was hoping for a little more there, because I think they could have taken the dwarves in a really interesting direction. But the
Kaladesh dwarves are kind of just dwarves. Like, a lot of their...
And that's the problem, though. I would have liked to have seen just a little more Kaladesh flavor in them.
Next up are the elves. The elves basically come in the two varieties, or two of the varieties that you see in the Player's Handbook. They have the wood elves, and they have the high elves, the magic-y elves. The wood elves live in a forest. They don't like all this technology stuff, so they're kind of old school in that regard. The city dwelling, the high magic elves, they live in the cities. Again, in the art book, it talks about where the elves generally live in Kaladesh and what the elf areas of the city look like, which is fascinating because they actually grow their buildings out of wood. Nothing too terribly new with the elves. Elves are elves. Elves in love with nature? No. Say it ain't so. That's crazy talk. After that are humans, which, surprise, humans are humans.
Yeah. I mean, they don't even get a full page. It's pretty much just like, keep on trucking.
So next up, we get our first new race, which they haven't done in any of the previous planeships, which is the...
Vedalken.
They're big, they're blue, they have 6 fingers. They're inventors. If you know your magic lore, they're highly represented by blue magic, so knowledge base, psychicness. I was reading about all the Vedalken in all of their other settings, and Kaladesh ones are different because they tend to be curious and occasionally smile. Again, as with everything, the section in the art book is much more detailed and interesting, but this gives you sort of the highlight reel, and of course it gives you the D&D rules to play them, which are pretty cool. That moves us into the final section of the book, which is my
favorite section of the book.
It's always the good section of the book, which is the bestiary. They get a lot of love to Kaladesh gremlins because they are a big part of the story.
Yep.
And basically what gremlins are is they secrete acid and they like eating refined ether. They're kind of like tribbles, except they eat fuel.
They're like crackhead tribbles.
Yeah.
I mean, they really want that ether.
Yeah, they'll tear a machine apart to get at the fuel tank, basically, and try to suck it all out with their sort of elephant nose. The piece of art they have is perfect for it, because the one in the foreground has this real crackhead manic expression on his face. Does. He's like, it's like that look that your dog gives you when you're holding like a treat, and it's like, do you want this? They're like, oh, heck yeah, I do.
And from there, it goes on to a lot of individual critters. It covers the angels and demons from the setting. It covers my personal favorites, the sky whales and Leviathans,
which if you again read the art book, but there's this whole whaling industry, except you're in flying ships and you're trying to hunt whales that move around in the clouds and stuff, which is crazy. And there's sky pirates in the setting too, because of that, which is fun.
And you've got hydras and giants, and it just goes on from there. One of the best things that I thought about the Monster Manual section is at the very, very end, how it covers some basic stuff like bats, bloodhawks, eagles, etc. And what it does is it introduces the concept of the Thopter. And this is a small little automaton that flies around. And basically, it gives you a variety of different ways that you can incorporate this basic concept using the D&D functions.
Which is basically to say, use the rules of a bat, a bloodhawk, eagle, hawk, owl, etc. Call it a construct and describe it as a Thopter, which is basically the oldest trick in the DM's book. I need a new monster. It's kind of like this. I'll just use the rules for orcs and describe it differently.
But you know what? It's an old trick because it works.
Exactly.
And they do a really good job of covering it here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the angels are just like, use this, describe them this way. The dragon is, use the red dragon stats, describe it looking vaguely like a tiger with glowy bits.
We do get some more new material with the artifact creatures.
Which are a big, they are a big part of the setting. I was almost hoping for a template, which isn't as much of a thing in 5th edition, but just like laying a construct animal template over just normal animals out of the back of the monster manual. But instead what they give you is they just kind of talk about it, which is, I maybe you don't even need those rules, because basically it's like, hi, I made a construct tiger. It has the rules of a tiger, and it also has the construct tag. Hooray!
Let's go ahead and wrap this discussion up, Robert. Give me your 60-second elevator pitch on your thoughts on Kaladesh, and most importantly, what do you think? Is it going to make for a fun D&D game?
I really like the setting. It reminds me a lot of Eberron, but it's different enough from Eberron that it can also be sort of its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has the same problem that Zendikar had, which is the existing D&D storylines that exist for 5th edition. So we're talking about Storm King's Thunder, Curse of Strahd, Tyranny of Dragons. Most of those stories, actually, I'll just go on a limb, all of those storylines wouldn't really work out in this. You might be able to pull off Princes of the Apocalypse, because a crazy elemental cult invading and doing stuff, you could probably mm-hmm. do. But that one doesn't have anything to do with a cool city nearby, which really misses the mark because... You know, most of the stuff, it revolves around the Inventor's Fair and all of the cool, the Garapur stuff in the big city. So you are kind of restricted in that you will have to run your homebrew. One of the strengths of the previous packet of Innistrad was it told you how to run the Curse of Strahd in Innistrad. It was brilliant. Part of the problem is there's no city-based campaign. Like, this really needs a city-based campaign, and so far we have not gotten one yet.
Yeah.
Now, maybe you can run Tales from the Yawning Portal and sort of file the numbers off. I don't know. We'll see what the future adventures hold. But if you want a very different setting that is oddly modern but still has a lot of fantasy elements... Kaladesh is really, really cool. The setting is really well thought out. The book is a really fun read, the art book. And yeah, you can definitely, there's definitely enough there that you can construct a campaign around. Even if you construct a campaign around the basic story of Kaladesh, which is evil artifact wizard Tezzeret comes, takes over the government, and now you're trying to get band all the various renegade factions together to actually become the renegades that the consulate warns everybody about to take back the government from this crazy wizard from another world. You could definitely run that storyline, and there's enough storyline stuff there that you can definitely do it. I really, really like it. It's definitely the most different setting out there, and it's just so cool. Definitely check this out. These magic settings are awesome, and there's a lot of lore to pull from, and it opens up just a brand new, whole new crazy space to go inhabit.
From my perspective, I think it's important to remember what we're looking at here. This is a free supplement. And the reason that's important is because this does such a good job at taking the D&D that we know and love and modifying it to fit this awesome new setting. Does it go far enough? No, I don't think it does.
I don't think any of them have, to be honest with
you. No, they really haven't. I think they do a really good job at giving you some very basic rules to work within. But I think the biggest thing that it's missing, and I feel especially bad for folks that don't have access to that art book, because that's where you're going to pull this from, and that is the tools to construct a story that fits within this world. Is it appropriate for them to not have put it in there? Sure, it's a free supplement. Like, I mean, I think it's asking
These are designed very specifically to be companions to this art book.
Yeah,
it's like get more value out of buying this art book by using it as a D&D setting.
I just think that there needs to be another 5 pages that talks about how to take what's in the art book and hang it into the framework of a plot. I think even for an experienced DM, this world is so unlike anything that D&D would ever even attempt that you need to be given a bit more framework to hang a story off of. But the problem is that this document doesn't tell you enough about the world. It does rely heavily on that art book. And even then, it doesn't reference the art book. I feel like there was an opportunity to do another couple pages worth of content specifically referencing sections of the art book and basically saying, look, you need to go to these pages and read this section. You can hang a story off of this or this, and you can hang
like
a story
a little, off like this. A little game mastery chapter.
Exactly, exactly. If anything, I feel like it would have made it a more effective sales tool for the art book as well. That being said, what's in here is fantastic. The Kaladesh world is fantastic, and I, for one, really would like to run a campaign within Kaladesh. I think it would be an interesting, entertaining campaign, and I think that the world is so removed from standard Dungeons & Dragons that it could be a really super engaging and fresh-feeling campaign.
Yeah, it definitely has a whole series of different tropes. Because, I mean, there's literally, like, trains in Kaladesh.
Yeah.
And cars, and...
This is the most imaginative, unique world I've seen in a game in a long, long time. It doesn't rely on the things that you've come to expect from a D&D game. It doesn't rely on the things that you've come to expect from any real storyline. It's fresh, it's new, it's unique, it's unlike anything. It deserves a bit more service from the company to put together something that will help people make stories that work within this unique and interesting world. But that being said, what's here is great. You really can't beat the price.
Yeah, no, you can't.
Taking into account the fact that it's free, that should make it an insta-buy for the art book, especially at the prices that you can find it on Amazon. Even for the MSRP of $39.99, getting a almost 250-page hardbound art book with nothing but fluff in it is a remarkable, remarkable value. I love Kaladesh. I think it's a great world. I want to play in it. This supplement does a really good job of almost getting you there. Ultimately, I think it's awesome, and it's like 85% of the way there.
Yeah.
So that is our deep dive of Plane Shift Kaladesh, which is available free from wizards.com. The art book is available everywhere, friendly local gaming store, online through Amazon. Go pick it up. If you're looking for an interesting place to have a campaign, this is a great one.
All of them so far have been good. Yeah. Like, great. Like, the Zendikar one was awesome to read. Zendikar is a great setting. Go read my review that I wrote of it. The Innistrad one is also awesome because who doesn't like dark gothic stuff and towns with tentacles, like our episode name. And then the forthcoming one, Amonkhet, it's Egypt run by a crazy, hyperly powerful, scary dragon, elder dragon, no less. So, yeah, that setting when it comes out next is going to be amazing.
Yeah, I got to tell you, they're getting me right there too. I love me some Egyptology. Yeah,
Egypt D&D is actually hard to find. Third party companies touch on it every so often, but Wizards never has ever gone there.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that one. I'll be
especially ancient or Egypt setting run by a hyper powerful scary dragon that's working behind the scenes.
Yeah,
that's gonna be.
I feel like I'll be building a deck out of that. Really, I got to tell you.
Nicol Bolas is scary. Hopefully we get stats for him, but that's the future. Come back in like episode, I don't know. By the time that comes out, we'll be in our 30s, I'm sure.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. Robert, any final thoughts for us tonight?
Yeah, there are. Go get all the free stuff for D&D. The plane shifts are amazing. Thank you, Wizards, for making them. They all thus far have been awesome. Yeah. And they've given me a very good excuse to buy those art books, which I've had a load of fun reading. I love reading campaign settings.
Yeah, to be 100% fair, we do bring up some criticism of the product, but that's just looking at the product as a standalone. When you take into account the price and the amazing worlds that they're giving you to play with, I think that they're an amazing value. I would love to hear from people the kinds of adventures that they're building within these expansions. So
if you've ever run Zendikar, Innistrad, or Kaladesh, which just came out, so if you're already running a campaign, good on you.
Yeah. I'd love to hear the kinds of storylines that people are putting within those campaigns.
Zendikar would be rad, too. Zendikar would be fun.
I think Zendikar and Kaladesh are the two that I'm most interested in hearing how people are playing in that world.
But if anybody's running Curse of Innistrad, like, tell us. That'd be awesome.
As always, we'll be back in a couple weeks with a whole bunch more stuff. We're not sure what's next up on the review train, but a couple titles that we've been flirting with and starting to explore include Blood Bowl, Arkham Horror LCG.
Signs are pointing that we'll have a new Overwatch character before then.
Yeah, so lots to talk about.
And Capture the Flag will be back, so maybe I'll be back in my Overwatch mania, and it's like, who cares about Mordor? Overwatch!
And as always, take a look at the show notes and join us on the Freebooters forums to have this lots of great discussion about this and many other wonderful, wonderful gaming things. And until the next 2 weeks, Robert, party on.
Party on, Jonathan.
The music you heard in this podcast was Intro by Elefiel and Retro Funk by Persephone, both used with permission via the Creative Commons license.